The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
This is a traditional teaching sometimes known as the Five Recollections. In the sutta or discourse they're taken from, they're called the five bases or subjects or themes for regular reflection. And that sutta explicitly mentions whether one is female or male, householder or house home leaver. These are five appropriate themes for regular consideration, reflection, or contemplation. So, what happened when you gave attention to these themes? Mike?
I was really surprised by that. I found that the aging had mostly positive connotations for me at this point, and even death didn't seem to stir up that much. But then the fourth one, like illness, had some resonances for me, but the fourth one just stirred up a lot that I was just found really hard to work with. Like I was having a lot of trouble. Like even though I know that to be true, and I've observed it to be true, and like the things that have changed, like always changed into something else. Like I had a very very hard time sitting with the idea that everything that I hold dear and happy will change, or I will change.
Could you provide one example of something?
I guess it was mostly in terms of relationships with people, and just times in my life, or time spent with different groups or with different individuals.
Yeah. And was that upsetting? Or difficult, or
yeah, I mean, it was kind of all three. It was hard to like sit with the uncertainty of that, or like I guess it was almost like living the loss of the things that I have now, and that was I found that very challenging. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course, with this kind of practice, there's no supposed to. Like, supposed to be hard, supposed to be easy. It's just however it turns out. Thanks. How about others?
I had done a practice one time where we had this book of the different stages of decomposition of corpse, and also there was a skull on the altar too. So that was my daily reminder. It was my daily reminder that of the impermanence, and those images came up, you know, quite strong. And
how'd you feel about that?
You know, I did not really, I seemed to have sort of an equanimity toward it. It did not really seem to affect me. You know, I seemed to, I didn't, it was just, you know, just neutral. Mm-hmm. and that. What I did have more of an emotional effect toward was loss of different capabilities as you get older, particularly when I see, you know, this is something I've been noticing myself, is, you know, throughout days, you know, is that you know, I know I'm aging. I'm 62, and it's not slowing down any at this point. But anyway, I see older people who are in considerably more difficult shape than I am, and I know that that is going to be my fate, you know, that that is coming my way. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have a sense of grieving around that, you know, that there will be, that that will happen, you know. And the other thing that came up too was the thought, you know, I kind of mix and mash because I'm not very good at keeping categories, about that moment of death that I've, you know, since I've aged, I've seen more people in the process of dying. And I see the difficult struggles that at that last, those last few moments, and wondering about clarity. And that gives me some fear, you know, not extreme fear, but also just that fear motivates me to practice. You know.
And with that, so you mentioned two emotions, grieving and just now fear. Were you able to have some space or container in which to let that grief or fear just be? How was that?
You know, I did not really, you know, that I do need to explore deeper. I need to go further on that, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair response. thanks. Anyone else? Back there.
Years ago, at a particularly anxious time, I went to this park in the city, and there's a oak tree that hangs onto its leaves, you know, through the winter, that comes out over over my head. And so I went there, and it's on the bluff on the Mississippi. And as I stood there, suddenly I became aware of how I'm surrounded, you know, by this tree, and I think a bald eagle went by, and I'm breathing the same air that they are. And I was struck by my insignificance, and it was such a comfort to feel insignificant and not have that striving and worry. And so I thought of that as we were doing the meditation today, and I think of that often.
Mm-hmm. Did any one of them in particular connect with that experience?
The being, the illness and death.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a fair amount of meditation around death, and what was interesting is the sickness, the death, those losses didn't seem to bother me. The most difficult piece was something happening to my children or grandchildren. We're a very close family, and I think that would be the most difficult issue to deal with. And I just found myself going back to the earlier breathing exercise with that. And just trying to let it sit there.
I guess I have a question, because I could kind of hear where you were going. And maybe because I work in hospice and I see a lot of people facing a lot of difficulty, and physically, and also just, you know, how family is ripped away at the end for lots of people. It's really an alone pursuit a lot. Anyway, I could hear where you were going, and because I have a sort of a shape-shifting ability or a training, I just said, I'm out of here. I went to the eternal, and I just sort of drew my energy up through the top of my head, and I like pierced like a ceiling, and I just started drawing down light. And I guess, you know, what, and it felt really safe, comfortable, golden, stable, not invulnerable, but not not really receptive to any kind of trauma, just kind of. And I thought, oh, I'm cheating. I'm going to do something about this. I'm not going to just sit here and like weep. I guess the question is, what is the role of the imagination in meditation and in our lives? Like, I guess if I was dying and I had any cognition at all, I would do something on that ilk if I could, so that I wasn't a suffering human being about this death. But that does happen to me. Like, if corners come to me, I'll somehow use my mind to, like, get out of dodge. And it's not always a bad thing. I mean, one time I was burned quite badly, second-degree burns in New York, and I really thought about all the men who had napalm or Agent Orange or whatever. Like, I just thought of a really worst-case scenario where they weren't given, you know what I mean? Like, you can use your mind. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what's your thoughts about that?
About imagination?
Yeah, about using, about the act of doing. Like, we think of meditation as being, I shouldn't do anything. And I said, well, I know how to do something with my energy, so I'm just going to send it up. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, one, meditation's a pretty diverse and ambiguous word. In Buddhist tradition, there are hundreds. Even in Theravada, there are dozens and dozens of ways to meditate. Metta meditation, meditation on compassion. I do meditation on forgiveness, gratitude. So that's a dozen practices there. The way I do all of those involve imagination, memory. To me, memory and imagination are kind of the same thing. One goes to the past, what we think happened. And I'm using the word think happened carefully, or what we believed happened. We call that memory. One form of imagination goes to the future, what we think will happen. And then there are other forms of imagination where we take something and we play with it. So I would say all of those, there's these, and then meditations on things like death involve memory and imagination. We remember things we've seen, heard, experience, and we from that can imagine other things. So all of that, there's a role for imagination in those forms of meditation. Mindfulness, some of the standard mindfulness-based practices don't have much of a role for imagination. But many practices do. And the question boils down to, just as with thought, when is memory, imagination, or thought skillful? When is it fostering healthy qualities, kindness, compassion, patience, open-mindedness, sensitivity, strength, commitment, faith? And when are they trapping us or blocking us in one way or another? So that's kind of a big general response to the role of imagination. And then it's for us to notice, okay, is this a direct sensory experience, a sound that I'm hearing right now, or a touch sensation that's happening right now, or an odor or a visual, or is it something I'm remembering? And memory isn't always what we think it is. So it's a little different than a direct, like, touch, like the breath. The breath as it is, not the breath as we remembered it or want it to be. So we, in mindfulness practices, we're working with basic stuff happening. And there's the five senses, and then there's what gets layered onto those. And then we learn to inquire, is this skillful? Where is this going? So if I start thinking in certain ways, if my form of logic starts operating, where does that take me? Does it benefit anybody? Or does it harm someone, myself, somebody else? To me, that's the basic discernment. Like you said, you knew where this was going. I'm curious, where was it going? Was that imagination?
Well, it was a number four, maybe. What was it again?
Number four is all that's beloved and dear will change, will become otherwise. Interestingly, people often assume it will change in a bad way.
Right.
Not always the case.
I guess I just said, well, if it changes, I will change, and I'm changing right now. That was my reaction to it.
So that sounds like a get out of Dodge.
Kind of. But, it gets a little confusing because if it does feel like a use of imagination in the present moment. It doesn't feel like constructing an image and living in it so much, or it feels like just a perception of focus. It's an energy thing, I think, but that it feels like it is a touch in the moment. Yeah.
Well, to do these practices well, it's good to have a way to keep grounded in now, so that we're aware, okay, I'm thinking of what might happen or I believe is likely to happen, or at least plausible. And we don't get lost in it to the degree we think it is happening, because it's not yet happening. But we're the way I see some of these practices is happening. Certain things have happened and we haven't looked at them very carefully, or our reactions got in the way. So we try to revisit them in a calm, stable way. Other things, we know the odds are pretty good they're going to happen in some form. And so we get ourselves used to that, so we're not blindsided. And we get them in a dose if our imagination can stay grounded in the present. If it starts to get too heavy, we can back out. And so we get to try on things in a way and kind of get used to or familiar, and at the same time cultivate our own inner resources for when the more difficult stuff does happen. Or for some of us, when the really good stuff happens, for some of us, that'll mess us up just as much. Too much success. Look at all the athletes and movie people and musicians. They're successful and it screws up their lives big time. That's maybe a cliche, but sometimes we get what we wanted and it's very confusing. So one way I think this practice works is we set up a grounded, relatively stable container and take in memories, knowledge about how the world around us operates. We've seen people get sick and die. We've seen people arrested for not doing anything. We read in the news people get shot for no good reason. How do we live with these things when they're gonna impact us, whether we wish to or not? And for some of us, to be able to get out of Dodge is a skill we may need. It's especially true of trauma survivors. The ability to check out is a survival skill. But long term, does it serve us long term? Do we reach a point in our lives where we can, the way I would put it, can we assimilate the wounds instead of check out? And I believe, I can't prove this, that some wounds will never heal, but we can live with them. And the wound doesn't run our life. And that's like, okay, we carry the wound. Including like aging. As things fall apart, as certain capacities diminish, can we carry that with grace? By the way, this would be too much of an intervention right now. The etymology of the word suffering is to bear under. And we use it to translate dukkha, and a lot of Buddhists want to get free of suffering. But if we really examine the etymology of the word, the ability to suffer is actually where we want to go. Anybody who's interested in this, I can share a chapter from a book by Helen Luke. The book is called Old Age, and the last chapter is on suffering, where, and it fits with the Buddhist idea of there's no way to liberation except through suffering. Although there are all the Buddhists trying to do an end around, which is part of the wording of this practice. I can't escape aging, illness, death, loss, change. So what am I going to do with these things that I can't escape? And the root of the Latin roots of the word suffering is you bear under it in a way that it doesn't weigh us down. Depression literally means it pushes us down. Etymologically, if we look at these things as Helen Luke does, suffering is not a bad thing. But it's a hard thing.
How do you learn to bear under a great suffering and still live a good life? Two people come to mind, Stephen Hawkins and Franklin D. Roosevelt, but how does the average person learn to bear under a great trauma and still live a good life?
It's a good question. I don't know I can answer it because I'm not sure I've had to live through a great suffering. So I can speak to the little and moderate things I've come across. The death of my teacher was very hard for me. Cancer was pretty hard, but not so bad because I never thought I would die. It was just a pain. Like being stuck in a job I didn't like. But I became a monk, so I avoided that one as well. I never had a career to worry about. So partly what I'm getting at is we take what comes and we explore. And this is where mindfulness is the starting point. When something is difficult, the Pali word dukkha that often gets translated suffering can mean difficult to bear. Things that are hard, difficult. And notice often in the way we talk, that's a frequent complaint. Oh, this is so hard. This is so difficult. And I'm not belittling that. But often there's the implication or assumption things should be easy. Who promised us that? When we land in this world, whether it's through rebirth or whatever, there was no promise that it would be easy. Maybe Westinghouse with their appliances or Apple with their technology make that promise, but the universe sure never did. So part of it is to examine things like what I just touched on, and there are many more examples how we think, or I at least, often have this little complaint. I want it to be easy. I want it to be convenient, pleasant. And taking in, oh, yep, it's not all that way. And then learning, actually, there's a lot of capacity in here to respond to the hard stuff. And often the capacity needs to grow and develop. And then to good spiritual practice, I believe, is where we develop our capacity before it's needed. I've had people come to me and say, oh, somebody I know has cancer. Any tips on how to teach them to meditate? And I try to reply, but inside I'm always going, it's a whole lot easier to meditate, learn to meditate when you don't have cancer, especially if you're going through chemo, radiation, or something. So if we're lucky, we get exposed to skillful tools before it gets heavy. It's still possible, but it's, when I was going through chemo, meditation was not easy. Chemo and screwed up kidneys and messed up blood and fatigue and all that doesn't make it easy to meditate. So I'm rambling, hopefully. So to me, is instead of thinking about the great sufferings, pay attention to the little ones that happen on a daily basis and find our resilience in those and not just blow them off, not just distract ourselves, change the channel. On the way up here, I was stopping at a Quick Trip, I think in Menominee too. And one of the people there was striking up in a conversation. I was running late. I didn't want to get in a conversation. So this was mildly annoying. And I caught myself, instead of that, just, I don't know why she wants to talk to me. What's it hurt if I'm friendly for 2 minutes? So I think that's my belief, that it's in these little things we develop our capacity when the big ones hit. Because who knows what that's going to be like. You can read biographies about those people, Nelson Mandela, Helen Keller. Hawking, or there's a great book, Far From the Tree by Norman Solomon. It's about all kinds of hard stuff that families deal with, like a deaf child and how, or powerful chapter about the parents of one of the Columbine shooters and how they've carried that of knowing their son, and they still have no clue why he did that. And they don't seem lost in guilt, but they live with that knowledge, their son did this. And there are a lot of families that live with that. One of their children or family members killed somebody or raped somebody. How do we live with these things? Oh, phew. Any ideas? I'm pulling on many resources, so I can't think of one book.
And not any particular one. I was just going to say there's a lot to sort of deal with. I mean, a lot of
Pema Chodron's books cover some of this, working with difficulties. She has a couple of really good ones. The Places That Scare Us. That's what comes immediately to mind. But there are others. But it's usually just sections of books instead of just one book.
Or the book I mentioned earlier, Old Age, by Helen Luke, who's a Jungian, and she draws a lot on mythology. So if you appreciate a literature mythology approach, The Tempest, Ulysses, she's real powerful, if that sort of approach. And the book I mentioned by Norman Solomon is incredible on empathy. How to just, this guy is, he really amazes me, his capacity to immerse himself in a community, such as there's a chapter on deaf people and all that's going on currently, at least, you know, that's not a community I know, or Down syndrome. And his capacity to just be there in a non-judgmental way with all the arguments, like in the deaf community, cochlear implants or not, sending your kid off to deaf school or not. These kind of debates that I didn't know anything about, and his capacity to just immerse, take it in, convey it powerfully with incredible empathy. And to me, I learned a lot from that about empathy and non-judgment. Yeah, but then let's give others a chance too.
How does a person develop resiliency, and would there be any good books on that too?
Yeah, I'm not that much of a book reader anymore, so I'm sorry, I'm not good at recommending. I tend to be an assimilator where I pick up things from books, from hearing talks, learning from people, and then I kind of assimilate as I go. I've learned a lot about resilience through Qigong. Qigong. It's a Chinese practice with energy, breath, and movement related to Tai Chi. I've learned a lot about resiliency through the practice we just did and reflections on death. I learned a lot from cancer and interacting with people who have cancer, which for me is very difficult. I survived, and it's very hard to be with somebody who's dying of cancer. I find that really challenging. So, sorry, I'm not good at recommending books on that particular theme.
I found that it created a connection for me between the idea that due to my aging, my children will have a loss of me and my death. And in the same turn, that I mean something to somebody so much that they will grieve me. But at the same time, when my father dies, I will grieve him, or if my child was to die, that we all have that moment of grief and we don't know when it's coming. Kind of like you saying you have your last, you know, your last breath is coming, but we don't know when. And when I went to that moment, I thought about the idea. For some reason, it brought me to the idea that there are tons of just trees here and buildings and everything that were here before us, and they will be here after us. And it kind of brought about an insignificance, like she was bringing up, mm-hmm. to know that and kind of accept that, you know, that that's my piece in the puzzle, that I'm just one piece and one drop in the bucket. So it gave an insignificance, but also a very big importance at the same time.
And I like to add to that, because it was part of my response to Anne, as we notice these responses, we can do a gentle inquiry, not a judgment, but a gentle inquiry. When is like these things that came to mind about around grief, noticing, oh, that seems healthy. I believe the capacity to hold grief, not trying to hurry it, not digging into it morbidly, but allowing grief, which for me is hard, that's a healthy thing. So there's a bit of gentle inquiry, noticing this is healthy. And then sometimes we notice a reaction that's pushing away or stuck or exaggerating. And we take that in as well. That's the mindfulness and inquiry part. As we, especially if we do a practice like this one regularly, not just once in a blue moon, then we notice how it changes over time. And we can notice where there is skill, and sometimes where skill is lacking. And that might be a clue, an area to explore further or deepen with.
I just wanted to ask a follow-up a little bit on something you mentioned earlier about how it was difficult for you to meditate during the time that you had cancer. And I'm just wondering, you know, what were the difficulties and how did you manage that?
Okay. First, I had 25 years experience when cancer hit, so I had a lot of meditation tools available. The number one difficulty is fatigue. For me, was fatigue. I would just keep falling asleep. There were periods I could not sit up in bed, and then more likely to fall asleep. So meditation was generally 5-10 minutes, fall asleep. 5-10 minutes, fall asleep. And so I accepted that. So that was one. Two, hospitals, there's noise, there's all kinds of commotion, so plenty of distraction. That didn't make it easy. So I just tried to draw on different tools. I did a lot of metta and gratitude practice late at night. That's when it was quiet. And because part of my chemo was steroids, there were all the sleepless nights. So part of it is just using the tools one has and the situation one is in. I did a lot of meditation on emptiness, like, is cancer me? Or when I had the IVs, you know, where does me start? Because emptiness is about emptiness of, it's about clinging to self. So a lot of reflection on, well, what's me in this? And could I say the cancer's not me? No. Is it me? No. What is me? Good question. I didn't have answers to these. I would just keep exploring them. And so, but that's somebody who had a lot of background with emptiness teachings or not self teachings. And I drew on that, which is part of what my comment was earlier. If we build up a repertoire before this stuff happens, we have resources to draw on. But if you do have somebody who is going through cancer, for example, and would like to learn to meditate, there are ways to go about that. Little steps, keep it easy, and adapt to the situation. But there's a lot of meditators trying to be helpful. If you're going through cancer or something like that, I'm not aware of anybody who wants to be told, oh, I know what you need. Meditate like me. Whack. It may be well-intentioned, but may not be so skillful. But there's so many practices available, meditation, otherwise body work, touch. There are plenty of things to offer people that they can work with.
Comforting, you know, it can be comforting to a person who is, you know, because they feel that sense of ease that you might have, you know, during that situation, you know, and so hopefully that is something that will not only influence my actions but also, you know, help the other person feel more calm, you know. Mm-hmm. That's maybe doing nothing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, in a way, meditation isn't doing anything, at least certain forms. You're just there. Okay, two more, and then I'd like to move to a closing practice.
In response to, well, I guess your comments about doing nothing is a lead into my meditation on death. Was kind of, I was reflecting on, if you don't know when your next breath is, then it's best to live life to the fullest while you can, right? And I've definitely done that in my mid-20s. Like, I didn't have the money to do it, but I went to Australia anyways on credit cards and stuff. And like, you know, the mentality was that, now you gotta do it while you're still alive. Enjoy your life.
Right. But then, drink and be merry.
Exactly. Yeah. That's been hedonistic, younger years. And I feel like, you did get a lot of good experiences from that. But at the same time, then when you're in the present, in the future, you know, then you're
paying your credit card.
Yeah. you pay the price. Yes. Eventually. If you don't die. But yeah, just the importance of, walking the middle path, I guess, in your everyday life and enjoying things in life, but at the same time setting yourself up to have a good future or a good present in the future, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. What are your recommendations for making choices to stay on that middle path?
That's a tough question because, one, what is the middle way? It's a lifelong exploration to kind of grow into middle way. So that's an ongoing thing. So I guess that means the first choice is to choose to really explore in actual life as opposed to theory. How do we keep finding or stumbling across the middle way, and what does it look like? Because it's never some off-the-shelf practice. Those are just little tools to help us find it. But merely following something in a book isn't the actual middle way. It can help us to get a sense of the middle way. So that's one. Two, And this is inherent in the classic teaching on the middle way. There are the two extremes. And those two actually bifurcate or proliferate into all kinds of ways we distract from the middle way. So we also learn what's not the middle way. And so how do we let it sink in that this isn't how I want to spend my life? Maybe something like you did, and then after a while you realize, no, this ain't it. Or for me, one of the things I'm grateful in a way to Donald Trump and the people who got him elected was, boy, I'm not going to ever, I hope, spend so much time reading all those news websites, political, Nate Silver. I spent so much time engrossed in that election, and what did it get me? So I'm hoping I learned my lesson. I'm not saying I should totally ignore that, but I way overdid it.
Research can't change reality.
And that wasn't even research. It was more like obsession. And I wasn't the only one. So that's part two. And then three is, so I'm giving you broad generalities or principles to explore. Three, when you start to see pieces of the middle way, what does it take to make that an ongoing part of your life? So say meditation. Various forms of meditation are a good bet for being part of the middle way. What does it take to sustain that? What does it take to have a really healthy, livable ethics? That's a tough one. Things are so corrupt these days. There's so much dishonesty. How do we actually practice healthy ethics nowadays? It takes a lot of support. Because there's far more support, maybe not far more, but there's plenty of support for the unethical. It's considered smart. And I won't name names. So that's how do we support conditions that enable the middle way? So inquiring into what is the middle way, what does it actually look like in your life, here, today, next month, this year, and what are the distractions you're still prone to, and what does it take to grow and strengthen the aspects of that that you can now see are important for you. Because too often we'll go off on retreat or something, have a good experience, and think, yeah, I got it. Nope. It's going to take a lot of support for that to keep going.
I guess... And the contemplation of death just had previously and a little bit reinforced today insights around just, you know, who's dying, whose body is it, and the sense that it's just more almost like public property that's just being returned. And not in a dissociative way, but and feelings of sort of gratitude for it's the way it is. It's almost like a natural passing to give space for new beings to arise. Mm-hmm. and being very grateful for that, because in a sense that if that it wasn't like that, the experience, at least that I notionally have had, would never have come to be.
Let's stop here, because I'd like very much to offer one more practice. Why don't we stand up, move a little bit. If you need to go to the bathroom, please do, but don't go too far, so we have time for one more practice and some conversation.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.